Certainly, please make sure to sign in the event that you are trying to apply this for credit, because if you aren't signed in, it sounds like a silly announcement, but it's necessary. If you aren't signed in, I can't confirm that you were here. So please make sure that you do sign in.
This is being recorded, I see.
It is being recorded. I'm just not doing video, just only audio.
Correct.
No, the recording is on. Everything that I say, as always, should not be taken as a practical halachic ruling. Please see your shul rabbi for psak on practical issues. Also, everything I'm saying should not be construed as legal advice. Be very clear about that one. The session this morning is dedicated in honor of a gift given by Eli Dadush to our dinner last June. I also want to make sure to note there are flyers over there. They stand out. They're bright pink. For a program called Tanakh in a Day. This is a program that my Beit Midrash will be running on Sunday, December 24th. It will be based in Yeshivat Or Chaim, 159 Almore Avenue. The address is on the flyer. It is a full day of classes on each book in Tanakh, in Jewish scripture, starting from the beginning and working all the way through to the end. Starts at 8:30 in the morning, ends at 9 o'clock. You do not need to come for the entire time. You can choose a book, choose a few that are of interest. It's open to everybody. It is free of charge. So hopefully you'll be able to make it for something there. Okay. Our topic this morning is helping a client to violate Jewish law. I brought you the rule from the Rules of Professional Conduct in source number one. A lawyer has a duty to provide courteous, thorough, and prompt service to clients. The quality of service required of a lawyer is service that is competent, timely, conscientious, diligent, efficient, and civil. I wonder if that's order of priority, how they did that. Okay. But there's a requirement fundamentally to provide good service. And so the question is, what do you do when it conflicts with your religious sensibilities? What do you do when the apparent best interests of the client don't match your own, not best interest is an odd term to use, but what you believe to be the right thing to do? And I brought you four cases which I want to look at, right below source number one. First one. Susan, an observant Jew, is a lawyer specializing in healthcare. The common denominator in all of these is that the lawyer is an observant Jew. The client is not necessarily, right? This we talked about in the class that we did in November, right, which was the flip side. The one in November was where the client is observant and wants to be able to go to secular court. That was the discussion in that class. And what can the lawyer do? What are the options that are available? So in this case, we're dealing with where the lawyer is observant and the question is what to do about a client whose needs conflict with the lawyer's or seem to conflict with the lawyer's observance. So, Susan, an observant Jew, is a lawyer specializing in healthcare. She is approached by David, who wants her help in navigating the system to procure medical assistance in dying. Susan does not wish to provide this help due to concern for Jewish law. Should she send David to another lawyer for help, right? What's called in the medical field effective referral. So the question here is not should she do it, but is it okay for her to refer this to somebody else? That's your first stage. Second stage. Mark, an observant Jew, is a lawyer specializing in trusts and estates. Rhonda, who just lost both parents and is dealing with hostile siblings regarding the estate, seeks Mark's advice to claim a share of the estate, which the Torah's laws of succession would not give to her. So she wants a share of the estate, which, if you were to go by biblical and rabbinic law, she wouldn't be entitled to. Leave aside the question of how one writes a halachic will that's beyond the scope of what we're dealing with, but fundamentally, she wants something which the law which Jewish law would not grant to her. Should Mark advise Rhonda regarding her legal options despite Jewish law? She'd tell her, you know, if you go to court, if you probate, whatever the specifics are, it doesn't matter for our case, but you have legal options within the system which you could exercise and thereby get a share which Jewish law would not have given you. So you see, obviously, this is much more now than referral. This is actually giving the legal advice. Then we ramp it up to a third step. Samantha, an observant Jew, is a lawyer specializing in commercial transactions. Jonathan is a Jew who is seeking a loan from a Jewish lender at 3% interest. Right? We are familiar with, hopefully, the biblical prohibition. A Jew is not allowed to lend money for interest to another Jew. Right? Generally speaking, interest-free loans are, there's a technical term for this, interest-free loans, from an economic perspective, are...
No.
Interest-free loans. Interest-free loans in financial terms are suicide. The interest-free loans are a bad idea, right? Because at best, you get paid back on time without litigation, and you've just lost opportunity cost, and you've just lost the price of the cost of inflation, whatever it is that that your money is worth less than it was before. You will not do well by extending interest-free loans. So from the vantage point of the Torah, it's a form of tzedakah. It's philanthropic for you to give somebody a loan. That way they have capital that they can then use to build a business, to farm their field, whatever it is they need to do. But that requirement, that obligation of you may not charge interest, applies specifically to your family. So so here you have a case in which a Jew wants to get a loan from a Jewish lender at 3% interest. He approaches Samantha to write up the documents. Samantha knows that Jewish law prohibits such a loan. Should she draft the documents regardless of Jewish law? So now, it's not just referral, and it's not just information, but she's actually involved in doing this. She is executing it. So that's stronger. And then the last case, which is the one that we said we would deal with in our November class, we said we would address it now. William, an observant Jew, is a lawyer specializing in litigation. Karen, a Jew, is suing her Jewish neighbor in a property dispute, and she approaches William to represent her, and specifically in that's all right. Specifically in civil court. That's what we're talking about in the in this case. I didn't actually say it in the paragraph, but Karen is suing her Jewish neighbor in a property dispute in civil court, and she approaches William to represent her. Should William represent this Jew in suing another Jew in civil court? So those are our four cases. In order to address this, we need to start from the beginning and frame the problem. So, we have a basic desire, both from the standpoint of halacha and from the standpoint of Jewish law, to provide access to justice. Right? We've talked about this in other sessions. We talked about pro bono work. We talked about advertising. There's a basic value of access to justice. In source number 2, statement from Chief Justice Nemitz in 1985, we have no doubt that the right to access to the courts is under the rule of law one of the fundamental pillars protecting the rights and freedoms of our citizens. Everybody has to be able to get legal representation, and therefore there is a strong duty on the part of the lawyer to answer the call. So in number 3, I brought you from the Legal Research Guide to Ethics, the lawyer's duty to the state includes the entity, its systems, and its people. The New Brunswick Code of Professional Conduct states, the paramount duty of the lawyer is to serve the cause of justice. The British Columbia Canons of Legal Ethics states, a lawyer owes a duty to the state to maintain its integrity and its law. And actually, the rest of this isn't relevant just yet. We're going to come back to the rest of the quote. But the point is, there is a duty to serve as a lawyer and to respond to the needs of the client. The same thing is true within Judaism. We have a very strong push to enable people access to mishpat, to enable people access to justice. There are several different terms that we use in Hebrew for it, but fundamentally, take a look at source number 4. A pasuk, a verse out of the Torah, Mishpat echad yihye lachem, kager ka'ezrachiyeh, ki ani Hashem Elokeichem. There were several verses I could have brought. I chose this one. You shall have one justice for yourself, meaning one for everybody, stranger and citizen alike. I am Hashem, your God. Hashem attaches his name. God attaches his name to this imperative for justice. The idea that everybody should be able to have access. It's seen in a number of ways. Perhaps you recall the story with Moshe, right? Moshe, the original lawbringer who is judging all the people himself and spends all day long managing the system until he is told, you know, it will be better if you set up a hierarchy of judges, and that way you will be able to manage and the people will be able to manage. Everybody will have that access to justice. So from that standpoint, if you just stopped at this point, I would say That's it. You have to take care of their needs, give them access to justice, and be done. But, of course, it doesn't work that way. And it doesn't work that way in the halachic system, and it doesn't work that way in a secular system, because there will always be cases you can't take because the client expects you to do something that is problematic, both within Jewish law and within the secular system. There will be cases where the client will come to you and ask you to do something that you cannot do. Right? And that's where we come back to the second part of source number three from the British Columbia Canons of Legal Ethics, which states, a lawyer should not aid, counsel, or assist any person to act in any way contrary to the law. Right? They're dealing obviously not with halacha. They're not talking about Jewish law. They're talking about secular law. But if a client comes to you and says, I want you to do something, and you know it's illegal, the answer has to be no. If you take a look at source number five, you find the statement of Lord Burkett as to why that's true. The advocate has a duty to his client, a duty to the court, and a duty to the state. But he has above all a duty to himself. And he shall be, as far as lies in his power, a man of integrity. No profession calls for higher standards of honor and uprightness, and no profession perhaps offers greater temptations to forsake them. I'm not sure that's true, but it sounds really nice, doesn't it? Right? It's very nice, the way he presents that. But I think quite a few professions might compete on this. But fundamentally, the point is, there is a duty to state, and there is a duty to self, that says that if a client asks you to do something that's illegal, you don't do it. And so you have source number six from the Rules of Professional Conduct. A lawyer shall not knowingly assist in or encourage any dishonesty, fraud, crime, or illegal conduct, or instruct a client or any other person on how to violate the law and avoid punishment. Right? Very simple, very straightforward. May not assist, may not encourage, and may not instruct. Right? Three levels. Assist, encourage, and instruct. All three are out. Same thing is true within halacha, within Jewish law. We have a standard of conduct, which even though one might agree to some kind of a code that says you're going to practice law to certain standards, we have a phrase that's used in the Talmud, that a Jew is mushba va'omid mehar Sinai. We already swore at Mount Sinai that we are going to uphold the Torah, and I can't accept a commission that's going to compel me to violate that initial oath. And that's where the conflict comes into play. So what do I do? So among the things that a Jew is not allowed to do, take a look at source number seven. Passage from the Talmud. The Hebrew is on one side, the English is at the top of the next side. As is my practice in these classes, I'm going to read out the English rather than read the Hebrew and the English aloud. I brought the Hebrew because it's important to have the authentic source. But in the interest of time, I'm just going to read out the English. We do not purchase goats, kids, wool, or tufts of wool from shepherds. Why not? Why shouldn't you buy wool off a shepherd?
Presumption it's not theirs.
Right. The presumption is that they got it from the animals that have been given to them to watch. Remember that the way they used to take care of shepherding, for all I know, the way shepherding is still done today. I have back issues like this of shepherding, today. But the way that shepherding was done was that you would take the animals out for a period of a month, 2 months, whatever it was, before you would finally bring them back. And in that time, the wool builds up, and there's a fear that the shepherd is playing a game here. The shepherd shears it, takes a little bit on the side, and sells it. So therefore, you're not allowed to buy wool from the shepherd. The presumption is that this is essentially stolen goods. Ditto for buying a goat or a young goat. The concern is it was born while he had the animal with him, and then he told the owner that the pregnant animal had miscarried, something had gone wrong, and now he has made money off of this sale. I'm not allowed to purchase these goods, but we purchase stitched clothing from them because these are theirs. If it's already stitched, we assume that the shepherd is not also a tailor on the side, and these goods must be legitimate. And then we may purchase milk and cheese in the wild, but not in urban areas. And that has to do with the fact that, generally speaking, if they're keeping the animals for that period of time, there's probably some kind of an arrangement with the owner of the animals who doesn't expect them to bring the milk to back into the city all the time. But the point is, what would I have thought? What would we have thought the reason is? Why is it that I'm not allowed to buy these goods if I suspect that they are stolen? What's the rationale?
You want to prevent
it's theft. I'm not supposed to profit from theft, right? That's what I would have thought the reason was. Maimonides says that's not the reason. I mean, it may be another reason, but take a look at source number 8 where he gives you the explanation. He says, one may not purchase stolen goods from a thief. Doing such things strengthens the hands of sinners and violates. Do not put a stumbling block before the blind. In other words, separate from any problem of profit from stolen goods is the problem of encouraging them in their theft. If they know that they have a market, then this is what they're going to do. So not only do I have a concern about watching my own actions, but I also have a concern for not putting a stumbling block in front of them. Now, important point here. Is the thief really blind? Either biologically or ethically?
No.
No. How many people really don't know that stealing is wrong, right? We generally, I mean, yes, there will always be people who just are, you know, their brain doesn't work that way. They aren't going to get it. But the vast majority of people, including thieves, are quite aware that stealing is wrong.
I'm sorry.
They're not blind.
I have an objection to what you're saying, and I don't want to go and say I don't really care, but I'm looking at this as like, to me, in Shepherd times, the idea that I'm going to take the sheep out for 2 months and I'm going to herd them, it would seem to put a stumbling block for me taking the job to tell me that I can't make a deal with the owner where I get 20% of the wool.
Oh, you can make whatever deal you want
so
with
it. You're telling me if I'm the sheep herder and I take him out there 2 months, I can't go sell the wool, but all I did was make a deal for 20% of the wool to take the sheep.
Right.
But you're presuming I'm a thief.
Right.
All you've done was put a stumbling block for me taking the job. And it's, again, I'm just saying I'm trying to raise a valid objection to this because it's an ethics class. I don't know if it's valid or not.
But right. So the answer, your question is an important question. The answer to the question is that there was a certain social norm in which that wasn't the way they did deals and is working on that presumption.
Okay.
But in the event that the norm in society is to make such deals, then the law is going to have to recognize that reality. It's a valid point. But the point that he's making here, that Maimonides is making here, is that when the Torah says, don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind, it doesn't mean literally that the person is physically blind, and it doesn't even mean that the person is ethically unaware. Rather, it's temptation, precisely. The fact that people are tempted to do something wrong renders them blind as far as this rule is concerned. And therefore, even though he knows full well, and I say, well, look, he knows what he's doing is wrong. I'm not tempting him. I'm not the one who's putting a stumbling block. Nope, I am not allowed to engage in this with him either. So that's the principle of Lifnei Iver.
It sounds like Rambam is saying only on that first level, I can't buy stolen goods from a thief, but I can buy stolen goods from the guy that he sold it to?
No, it's just that then I tend not to be aware. In other words, at a certain point, you know, if the guy is standing on...
Don't buy stolen goods. He says, don't buy stolen goods from a Gosman. Who else am I going to buy it from?
I don't know, but again, I think that's because that's the one you're likely to know that it you're likely to know about. I think that would be the straightforward answer to it. If you look at the Rambam there, the part that I skipped in the translation, I think you'll see the cases that he gives there are more broad than the specific thief. So there's an issue of lifnei there, not to put a stumbling block in front of the blind, and then there's a second prohibition which we're going to see discussed. I didn't bring you a source directly on it yet, but we'll see it. And that's called misayeya. What does the Hebrew word misayeya mean?
To help.
To help, to assist. And not only am I prohibited biblically from causing somebody to stumble by tempting him into this sin, but I'm also not allowed to assist people. This is a rabbinic prohibition. I'm not allowed to assist people in sinning. And again, we'll see specifics and cases in a little bit. But that's another issue that I have parallel to what we already saw in the law society. In other words, this is parallel to source number 6. A lawyer should not knowingly assist in, right? You're not supposed to assist it in any way. You're not supposed to encourage it. And in source number 9, I bring you a piece from the Talmud, which I'll explain outside of the text, but you have the text there to look at. There was a king, going back to Roman times, a king by the name of Agrippus. Agrippus was not a legitimate king in the eyes of Jewish law, and he read a biblical verse that speaks of a proper king you place upon yourself and an improper king, and he starts to cry. He says, you know, I'm inappropriate as a king. The sages encouraged him and said, don't worry, you are our brother, you are our brother. And as the Talmud records, they became liable for destruction. They used the euphemism, the enemies of Israel. I mean, it means the Jews. They're liable for destruction because they flattered him. And this is what's called in Hebrew, chanufa. There's a prohibition against flattering somebody who's doing something wrong. In other words, to use the phrase from the Law Society, encouraging them in wrongdoing. That's inappropriate as well. In addition to which, I have an active mitzvah, and here Jewish law goes beyond the Law Society. In source number 10, do not hate your brother in your heart. Instruct, hocheach tochiach in the Hebrew, instruct, and do not bear sin for him. There is a mitzvah within Jewish law to tell people when they're doing something wrong, right? All those times when you want to say to somebody, mind your business, right? Their answer is, well, the Torah tells me that I have to mind your business. I have a responsibility to tell you what to do. Now, that's a hard rule to actually put into practice properly. The idea of instructing somebody else is a minefield, and we have to come back to that. But what I'm trying to show here is that you have limitations in the civil system saying you should not assist, advise, or encourage the violation of civil law. And we have within Judaism these principles of not assisting, not advising, and not encouraging violation of Jewish law. In addition to which, in Jewish law, there's an extra thing, there's an extra rule, which is to dissuade people from wrongdoing. Are we clear? Got it? Okay. So what we have to deal with is basically two questions that arise. How far do I need to go to avoid violating Jewish law? The general principle within the Canadian system puts access to justice above the lawyer's personal conscience. Even if you don't like what somebody is doing, you're still obligated to follow through on the retainer. Take a look at source number 11, please. From the Rules of Professional Conduct. A lawyer shall not withdraw from representation of a client except for good cause and on reasonable notice to the client. Mind you, this is where you're already representing the client, right? As opposed to taking the retainer in the first place, which we also have to talk about. But a lawyer is not allowed, shall not withdraw except for good cause. Does not tell me exactly what good cause is, but we'll see. The commentary to that rule says, although the client has the right to terminate the lawyer-client relationship at will, the lawyer does not enjoy the same freedom of action. Having undertaken the representation of a client, the lawyer should complete the task as ably as possible unless there is justifiable cause for terminating the relationship. So I went looking on Canley to try to find definitions of good cause in actual cases that have been dealt with. And basically the only good cause cases that I have found are related to fees, right? Lack of payment of fees tends to be good cause. That's about it. I did find, though, a very interesting distinction between the American system and the Canadian system. In the American system, as enshrined in the rules of various states, a lawyer is allowed to leave a case when the client's conduct is repugnant to the lawyer. So take a look at number 12. I found this in a ruling out of Alberta. On the difference between the American and Canadian systems. The authors of the Law of Lawyering make the following comments about the differences between the ABA's model rules of professional conduct and the restatement of the law governing lawyers. Other listed reasons for permissive withdrawal are more controversial and should be employed with correspondingly more caution precisely because the breakup of the client-lawyer relationship can less clearly be laid at the client's door. Indeed, for withdrawals based on these grounds, Restatement 32.4 specifically requires recalibration of the competing harms. If the harm to the client significantly exceeds the harm to the lawyer or others that prompted the impulse to withdraw, withdrawal is no longer permissible. In other words, for the factors we're about to mention to justify withdrawing, you have to carefully look at whether you're going to hurt the client more by withdrawing than you would be hurting the lawyer by staying in the arrangement. And now you get the example. A chief example is withdrawal in the face of client choices that the lawyer finds, quote, repugnant or imprudent. See Model Rule 1.16, and so on. Read too broadly, these provisions would permit lawyers to abandon clients at the first sign of disagreement or unpleasantness, which is antithetical to what a proper client-lawyer relationship should be. Clearly, lawyers ought to give clients the benefit of the doubt and not withdraw unless the disagreement is fundamental and the client's position so extreme as to be nearly impossible for most reasonable lawyers to countenance, and so on.
In American, correct.
In the American system, there is a concept of withdrawal because of the repugnance of what the lawyer sees and what the client is doing. I should note, I said that problems with fees are good cause. There is one other good cause that I did see in the literature, and that was loss of confidence between them. And that's its own discussion, but that's very important as well. So the question now is, you're in the Canadian system, you're following the Law Society of Upper Canada. Right? Actually, no, it's no longer called that now, right? Law Society of Ontario. I have to catch up. But within the rules here, you aren't able to say, well, what they want me to do is against my religious code. So what do? You could theoretically be sanctioned. You could potentially lose the ability to practice law. At the very least, you could face a fine. So what exactly will Jewish law expect?
Differentiate the situations where you already are counsel versus the ones
correct.
Where they're asking you to be the lawyer.
Right. Now, like I said, we're gonna address that. You are correct. That will be part of this calculation. I mean, I distinguished, I think, in the cases that I gave in the beginning as well. She is approached by versus someone who is already a client. So the answer is yes. We have to make that distinction. Jeffrey pointed out something to me that I don't think is directly relevant yet, but it could at some point. The Law Society is now putting into place a new requirements in terms of equality, diversity, and inclusion in terms of your practice, in terms of your who you employ within your practice. But one wonders about the possibility down the line in which a Jew is a lawyer and says that, well, this potential Jewish client wants me to do something Jewish law won't allow me to do, and therefore I decline, and they could actually take it up with the Law Society under equality, diversity, and inclusion. If this had been a non-Jewish client asking you to do this, you would have said fine. Now it's a Jewish client, and now you have a problem. Yeah, that's not there yet, but I wonder.
The Ontario Human Rights Code would probably cover that already.
Could be. It's not lawyer specific. It would be just, in general, right? A Jewish lawyer getting in trouble for turning down a Jewish client could be sued for discrimination. Okay. We have enough on our head. So let's talk about these cases now. Now that we understand the problem that we have, where you have certain expectations on the part of the actual or prospective client, and they conflict with Jewish law, and we have this idea of not encouraging, not assisting, not advising. So what do you do in these cases? The first case that we dealt with was the referral case. Based on what we have said so far, Susan is the observant Jew. She's a lawyer specializing in healthcare. She is approached by David, who is not her client, but who wants help in navigating the system to procure medical assistance in dying. She does not want to provide the help. Should she send David to another lawyer for help? What would you say based on what we've said so far? Should she refer?
Well, I have a solution.
Yeah?
Number one, I would not make a specific referral. But number two, I would say, there's a free lawyer referral service run by the Law Society of Ontario. Feel free to call the lawyer referral service. You can get a referral.
Right. So one approach to it, and that's been made available specifically in this area of law, the medical assistance in dying area, is essentially to become a second-level referrer, where you refer them to an agency that will take care of finding somebody on their behalf. So you are still enabling them, but you are now an additional step removed. But let's say, I gave you one case as an example, but you can come up with others right? Let's say we took the interest case, right? The case that I gave in number three, where they want you to write up the documents for a loan with interest from another Jew. So the Law Society has not set up a free referral service for business loans. I think.
Oh,
and you can do that. You can go to them.
Any lawyer, any time you can refer to it. They are lawyers who specifically sign up for
it. That's not legal aid.
No.
It's different.
Right. No, just an open referral service.
Half an hour free advice.
Okay, so then I'll
ask. There's a fee for the lawyer referral service.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that's an issue, because to get the referral from the Law Society referral service, the client has to pay the Law Society.
Whereas if they come to you.
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's a normal 100%.
Okay, so we have machlokas here among the lawyers. Which is a shock.
There's a nominal fee, but there is a fee.
The lawyer has to pay to get off the panel.
No, you don't.
No.
Okay. Okay, so I'll tell you what. I am planning on...
Right about that. You have to pay a referral fee.
I'm planning on sending out a clarification by email once we know what the story is with this open referral service. Is this a fee service or not? Don't look it up now.
I've done
that. But I will let you know once I know how this works. But in terms of the general question, you still have the same fundamental problem. The same fundamental problem is, am I allowed to send somebody? Now I know I am two steps back in the process. I'm no longer directly sending them to somebody who will help. I am sending them to somebody who will help them find someone. And the question is, am I allowed to do that in Jewish law? If you take a look at source number 13, you find the relevant rules from the Law Society. A lawyer shall make legal services available to the public in an efficient and convenient way. That's the rule. Then the commentary. Right to decline representation. A lawyer may decline a particular representation, except when assigned as counsel by a tribunal. That's a different story. But that discretion should be exercised prudently, particularly if the probable result would be to make it difficult for a person to obtain legal advice or representation, right? Access to justice. A lawyer declining representation should assist in obtaining the services of another licensee qualified in the particular field and able to act. When a lawyer offers assistance to a client or prospective client in finding another licensee, the assistance should be given willingly and except where a referral fee is permitted without charge. So you're responsible, and this is, you know, going back to Yechiel's point, this is regarding somebody who isn't yet your client. Which to me is mind-boggling, the level of assistance that's required. In other words, I'm a lawyer, I have my shingle, I'm not a lawyer, but if I were, I have my shingle out, just by dint of being a lawyer, I am now responsible, and if somebody comes to me, I have to at least send them towards someone who can help them. I mean, that's the way it works. This is part of the legal profession's view of itself as having a duty to the state, having a duty to society, and making sure that people will have legal representation. So even to somebody with whom you have no prior relationship, doesn't make a difference. You have that level of responsibility. Not only that, but take a look at 14, which is the other rule that's relevant for this case. Upon discharge or withdrawal, a lawyer shall cooperate with the successor legal practitioner so as to minimize expense and avoid prejudice to the client. ... Commentary. Cooperation with a successor legal practitioner will normally include providing any memoranda of fact and law that have been prepared by the lawyer in connection with the matter. So you got to turn over materials and communicate with whoever is your successor, and that comes back to what we're expecting you to do in terms of referral. It's much more than just, here is somebody's business card, or here's a phone number for you to call. If you are already working on the case, you're going to be responsible to turn over materials and so on. So we have to ask the question now. Within Jewish law, what is it that you would be able to do? So I'm not going to talk about the lifnei iver, the stumbling block issue, as much on this case, because I'm going to do it in the next case, the issue of advising of options, and it's more directly relevant there. The issue of chanufa, of encouraging people, is not really so relevant when you look at this case, because your refusal to represent, I think, confirms for the client that you don't approve. So it's not an issue of, am I encouraging them in what they're doing? I'm not encouraging them in their, in it. However, do I have the problem of assisting them? And do I have some kind of an obligation to instruct them in, under Jewish law, to tell them this behavior is no good? Yes, I know the law society will not want you to do this, but that's my question, is what does Jewish law expect of the Jewish lawyer? So first of all, in terms of assisting, would we view referral as an act of assisting? How would you define referral as assisting?
In some respects, it could be.
I don't say it cannot be.
Yeah, it sounds an awful lot like assisting. If it weren't assisting, why would we be required to do it?
Because it doesn't mean the client will even know about this option. So you're assisting the client by telling them there's an option.
Right. I mean, it sounds like a problem, no? It sounds like a problem. This is bad news, right? For anyone named lawyer in the room, this is a problem.
Well, when does it cease to be a problem? You know, you tell the person to go away, so going away, that's assisting them because you're not going to help them. So you tell them to go away, that's assisting them at some level, but I'm assuming that shouldn't be a problem.
Right.
But, you know, you tell them to go away and go to somebody particular, that would be more of a problem, who's going to really help them.
Yeah.
And you send the lawyer referral service, well, you know, that may be a gray area.
So it depends on the level of assistance that I'm providing. Right? How direct or how good? Sorry?
No. Yeah. I think going away is problem, but it's a problem in the law society.
Right. So here, I think it's important to recognize that, first of all, this prohibition against assisting is a rabbinic prohibition rather than biblical. There's some debate about where exactly, what biblical heading it comes under. Is it a function of my obligation to instruct people to do right, tochacha? Is it under my obligation of keeping people from wrongdoing? If you have to keep people from wrongdoing, you certainly can't assist them in the matter. There's some debate. But it's worth knowing that it is rabbinic for a few reasons that we'll see, but among them is the fact that it is very limited in its application. Going back to Talmudic times itself, it was limited in its application. If you take a look at source number 15. Number 15 is a passage from the Mishnah. We're going back now a couple of thousand years. Dealing with an issue of impurity, the view of this Mishnah, which happens not to be the law in Jewish law, but the view of this Mishnah is that as a Jew... I am not allowed to cause ritual impurity for Israeli produce. So, not talking about truma, tithes, not talking about that, but general produce in Israel, I can't render it impure. So, for example, the easiest example, if there's a room with a dead body in it, I can't bring that produce into the room. I'm not allowed to cause it to become tameh, to use the Hebrew term. However, what about working with a Jew who is himself impure and is going to contaminate the produce? He's going to render it ritually impure. So from source number 15, one may neither trample nor harvest grapes with a Jew who processes them in impurity, but one may bring barrels to the press with him and bring barrels from the press with him.
You're enabling.
I am enabling, for sure. So why is it okay? And the answer is that the prohibition is limited. The prohibition against assisting somebody in wrongdoing applies specifically during the wrongdoing itself. Even though, from an ethical standpoint, I might look at it and say, but I'm still assisting, the rabbis did not go that far in their prohibition. They said, you may not assist during the act, but anything that is beforehand is going to be allowed. And that's why they allow you to bring the barrels to the press, even if they don't want you to actually crush the grapes to make the wine. That's the idea. And that's one reason to permit. Second reason to permit is that you aren't really the enabler, in the sense that this assistance is available elsewhere. You are not the sole source of assistance. If you take a look at source number 16, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg makes this point. It's based on a Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Avodah Zarah. He says, one should also not omit the views of early authorities that there is no prohibition against aiding unless the help cannot be duplicated elsewhere. If my assistance is not unique, then I am allowed to provide it because they're going to get it from me. They're going to get it somewhere else. It doesn't make a difference. You follow? That's the argument that Rabbi Waldenberg makes. Rabbi Waldenberg's statement is actually in medical context. He's dealing with the question of a doctor who provides supportive services that enable an abortion where the abortion is not justified by Jewish law. And his answer is that where, if you don't do it, somebody else is going to do it. I think his case was doing an ultrasound, which would enable the abortion. So if they don't go to you, they're going to go to some other technician. Then he said the ultrasound is allowed. It also has there's a ruling along the same lines, which we're going to see later, from Rabbi Gedalia Felder, who was of course here in Toronto in a law case. I'm just not set up for that case yet, but we're going to see him say it as well.
Yeah, the ultrasound is. I don't believe the ultrasound is allowed because the person, you may refer them or say I'm not doing the ultrasound for you or whatever. If you refer them out of your place, between your place and the next place they go to get that ultrasound, they may very well wake up and decide that while they may, I'm just framing an argument, they may decide that while they have the woman's right to choose and control their body, absolutely, that baby's body is a different issue.
Right. So
they may change their mind between this ultrasound and that one. So right. You expediting the process, in my view, is problematic. I apologize for my objections, but...
It's okay. Because fundamentally, it highlights a very important point, which is, this is not about preventing it. This is not about an attempt to prevent the act from taking place. Rather, this is about you not being a participant in the act.
I'm sorry.
And therefore, it's... I understand. If you want to take it further, we can take it further afterwards.
No, it's not about that.
Okay.
We have prohibitions specifically in the Law Society that says if they come with you some nonsense, you have to keep it to yourself. If they come to you and they threaten they're going to go kill the prime minister, you have to call the police.
Right.
If this person's going to murder that baby, you can't assist them.
Right. I was dealing with that case from a medical perspective rather than a legal. Okay. So
you're wrong.
Okay. But that's the point here is that number one, your help is indirect. Number two, you aren't really the enabler of it because they could get the assistance somewhere else. And then there's a third point, which is in source number 17. I'm going to explain it outside of the text, but you can see it there, which is, in general, the prohibition against assisting somebody in wrongdoing applies specifically where this is a person who, without your wrongdoing, without your assistance, I should say, might do it, might not do it. If this is somebody who is, to use the Hebrew terminology, a mumar, somebody who rejects the law, who outright rejects the law, then there is a substantial view, as brought in number 17, who say that that there's nothing wrong with you assisting. So for all of those reasons, the general assumption is that you are permitted to refer. Right, Michael Broyd notes that the Rav Avadia Yosef was more strict if you were dealing with a biblical prohibition than with a rabbinic one. But the general assumption is that your assistance here, because it's indirect, meaning it's before the act, and you are not the only one who would have provided this assistance, justifies being the referrer in this, so that somebody comes to you and says, I would like this, you would be entitled, even without there being the step in between of the free, open referral service, you would be allowed to refer to somebody else.
Is it obvious then that the equation changes if you're the only specialist?
Yeah.
Who can provide that service.
Right. You would still have the argument of I'm helping beforehand as opposed to during the act, but you lose the justification of saying that they would have gotten it from somebody else. There is a flip side to this, though.
Can you take a referral fee for that?
Can you take a referral fee for such a... Right. Can you take a referral fee... before having done this. I would suggest not to. I mean, there is a lot of discussion about this in the case of a physician who works on Shabbos. Is the physician allowed to take payment for that, you know, for that work, where what they're doing is justified? You know, they're in the business of saving lives. Are they allowed to take a fee for that? And there are several different factors involved. I want to think this through in terms of its application here. Let me keep that one as well for the follow-up email, because I'm not sure.
What? That works on Shabbos. Can he take a fee?
Right, but that's a different story, because there he's being paid for the training that he undergoes and the preparation he does beforehand. Here you'd be taking a fee for the actual act. Yeah?
Sorry, is this is going off tangent a little bit, but this is Eliezer about...
Yeah.
Would that apply also to an abortion provider, saying, for example, that an observer...
Right, so we're going to come back to that question. We're going to get to that question in the third vignette.
Providing an ultrasound and actually providing the abortion.
Correct.
Whereas,
right, we'll get to...
Others could go to other...
Understood. Understood. The third vignette will address that, because that's where you're actually involved in the act, as opposed to just enabling it. But the other question you have to ask is, even if I'm not liable in Jewish law for the fact that I enabled the wrongdoing, what about my mitzvah of tochacha? What about my mitzvah of instructing others in what Jewish law expects? So here it's really important to recognize source number 18. This is a passage out of the Talmud. Rabbi Yilah said, quoting Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, just as there is a mitzvah to say that which will be heard, so there is a mitzvah not to say that which will not be heard. And Rabbi Abba goes one step further and he says, it is obligatory. He quotes you a verse, do not rebuke a scorner lest he hate you, rebuke a wise man and he will love you. Right? From Mishlei, from Proverbs. So you're not allowed to speak up in a way that people will not receive. And that's a very, very important principle, which leads to source number 19, Tosfot, writing in, as I wrote there on the sheet, 13th century, roughly, Western Europe. They're talking about a case described in the Talmud in which someone was held responsible, or really a group of people were held responsible, for not preventing others from wrongdoing. So Tosfot said, this, meaning this responsibility for not preventing it, that's where one doesn't know whether they will accept. If you're not sure whether people will listen, then you are responsible to speak up. As the Talmud says in this story, is it obvious to them that people won't listen? But where they definitely will not accept, leave them. Better for them to sin accidentally than intentionally. All you're doing is making things worse if you're going to apprise people who are doing something by accident that what they're doing is wrong, and they're not going to listen to you anyway. So there is a limit on the expectations in terms of instruction, and to which I would add, again, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg in that same responsum in source number 20 adds that one need not lose one's parnasa, one need not lose one's living in order to instruct somebody else. So in other words, the guy comes to you, right, and you give him a hard time about the fact that he wants to do this, and as a result, there's a complaint to the Law Society because you're not entitled to impose your system on the client, and you get sanctioned as a result, or you have bad press as a result, and now people can Google your name and find that you were censured in this way. So you would not be expected to go to that extreme. So what we're saying is, to sum up this case, number one, the issue of misayeya, the issue of assisting, will not apply if your assistance is indirect, if you're not really the enabler because they can get help elsewhere, and especially if they were a mumar, they were going to do it anyway. And the obligation to rebuke, the obligation to instruct, is limited to a case where there's a possibility that it's actually going to be effective. Otherwise, there isn't, and certainly there's no obligation to endanger your livelihood for it. Yeah.
As I'm listening to this, and I'm looking at your second case scenario.
Yep. Which is coming up.
I want to make sure that we're clear whose understanding of halacha governs.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in your second case scenario, your premise is that someone trying to enforce their understanding of their entitlement under the last will and testament may be flawed because it's contrary to the forced heirship regime of halacha. But there is a halachic opinion that wills today are okay if you take under a will. Right. There's another side that says you're a guzzlin if you take under a will.
Right.
So is it, if your client's understanding is in accordance with the thing that it's permitted to take under a will, notwithstanding that your rep may have been told you differently, whose position got first?
Right. So the will case is a separate one because that's why I framed it the way that I did. I didn't want it to be about whether you can honor a will within halacha or not. But taking the question more broadly, it's an important point. I'm the lawyer, and I have one approach to the law in this case, but there is another legitimate approach that they could use. We have a principle in Jewish law called Kimli. Kimli, right? It doesn't sound Hebrew; it's Aramaic. But Kimli means essentially, I'm allowed to say I follow this minority view, and therefore for me this is an all right thing to do. So where it's a legitimate view, it may not be unethical for somebody else to assist in the practice because there's nothing wrong with you following this view. That's what I would say briefly.
And I think it's important, especially in your second case scenario, because
yeah.
I know a lot of people here make wills.
Right.
And a lot of people litigate wills here.
Yep.
Is that in speaking to somebody recently who's has hands-on in the Beis Din adjudication of these issues, they honor, if somebody comes before them for Das Torah and says, which way do we go? Do we do the forced heirship regime or do we go in accordance with the will? They go in accordance with the will. And I specifically pose the question, you know, Rabbi Rezikoff says that you're a guzzlin if you take according to the will. And they said no. For the most part today, the Batei Dinim say no, you can go in accordance
okay.
with the will.
Good. I'm going to leave that aside because we did the class, whatever it was, 2 years ago, I think, on wills, and I can refer people back to that for the conversation that we had back then. But I'll send out the link to it later. It is a worthwhile point.
Let me ask a question.
I would read it.
Is there an obligation on the part of the lawyer who is refusing to take the case before the retainer to explain to the client why he or she will not take the case?
So, from a Jewish law perspective?
Correct.
So, only if I'm concerned about chanufa, about encouraging them by sending them to somebody else, which to my mind you aren't, unless you actually state something encouraging. You know, in other words, simply saying to them, I'm not going to take this case, so-and-so deals with it, or there's a referral service, I don't think constitutes encouragement. Encouragement is more along the lines of what you saw that in that passage from the Talmud in which they say, you are our brother, and it's fine, and so on. That's really, I think, the way we define encouragement. That's what I would look at it.
Can I ask the flip side of that?
Yeah.
Depending on what the issue is, but taking the first one that you brought up, somebody comes to you with an end-of-life issue, they're looking for assistance, and you don't know for sure, that's a lot of people don't know.
Yeah.
How somebody's going to react to the situation. Aren't you from a drug perspective obligated to try and encourage them to maybe step back from that? Or and I'm sure the law society would not look at it like that. You have no business encouraging them or discouraging them.
Right.
From a drug perspective, this is a pretty big one.
Right. So what I would say is to make the distinction between your personal moral obligation and what Jewish law is going to require of you. From a Jewish law requirement perspective, I think that no, you are not under this responsibility for the reasons we've outlined under rebuke, you know, under tochacha. Having said that, it could be stated that there's a moral obligation anyway for you to find some way to, you know, encourage them to live, but it's a dicey thing. Right, you could get yourself into a lot of trouble. Number one, and number two, I think that there's a law that is often honored in the breach called Onas Devarim. Right, you're not allowed to harm somebody else with your speech, and that includes when you're trying to tell somebody to do a good thing. Right? If you read the book of Eov, the book of Job, in which his visitors are all talking to him about God and about how if you're suffering, it's because you did something wrong and all that. They have the highest ethical ideas, and yet the Talmud says this is the paradigmatic case of onas devarim, of abusing somebody else with your words. They have the highest religious ideas in mind, and at the end of the book, God says they spoke wrong. So, you know, you don't get a higher court. So I think one would have to be really, really careful in a sensitive case like that to make sure that they're not stepping over that line in the name of their religious ideals. Okay. Second case. In case anybody is concerned, the first one was the longest of the four. I'm mindful of the time. You're getting 1.5 credit hours, and I intend to use them. The second case, advising of options, and that's a good time to remind people to sign in if they didn't. Advising. And turn off their cell phones. Advising the client of the option, such as in the estate case, that's number two. So, in terms of miseyeya, in terms of helping them, it's still an indirect assistance. You're giving them information. That's all you're doing. In terms of tochacha, of giving them religious instruction, assuming that you know they aren't going to listen, or assuming you would lose money by instructing, that imperative falls away as well. We still have the principle of not encouraging them in wrongdoing, and that will apply. But the big question here, when you advise them of their options, is the one I deferred from case one, and that's lifnei iver, putting a stumbling block in front of the blind, or as we said, in front of the tempted. So what's the rule going to be in this case? Are you allowed to advise the client of the options? And for those who don't like the will case, construct another one where you're going to advise them of options.
Intestacy, right? It's an intestacy case.
Yeah, so right. That was the way I conceived of it.
Right.
Right. So what's your feeling? Can you advise the client of the options? More, this is stronger now than referral. Do you have the option of saying to them, here is what you could do, not to mention potentially taking a fee, going back to that question, for having given them this this advice? Right. So what would you say?
If they can get the advice elsewhere, then you
right. So if they're able to get that advice somewhere else, can you make the argument that you are not guilty much the same way that we made the argument regarding assisting? So that's a key point in this conversation. If you take a look at your sheet, it's source number 21. This is a passage from the Talmud, and it's the central passage on this issue. It's dealing with the issue of causing somebody else to stumble. There is a law of the Nazir in Judaism. A Nazir is somebody who has taken a vow to observe certain laws, including that they're not going to drink wine. Not going to have great products, actually, technically. That's one rule that's relevant here. The other rule that's relevant here is that there's a prohibition for all human beings not to eat flesh taken from an animal while the animal is still alive. The animal has to be dead before anybody can take flesh from it. So the question that's asked in the Talmud here is, what if you extend to a nazir a cup of wine? What if you hand flesh taken from a live animal to any human being? Are you in violation of the prohibition against putting a stumbling block in front of the blind? And the Talmud distinguishes between two cases. One is a case in which the prohibited item and the person who's not allowed to use it are on the same side of a river, and therefore it's openly accessible, versus where they're on two different sides of that river. And the statement is made that it is called putting a stumbling block before the blind if I give it to them from one side of the river to the other. But if they're on the same side of the river in the first place, meaning it was accessible to them from the start, then I am not in violation. And this is what we invoked earlier regarding miseyeya, regarding assisting. So take a look at source number 22 for an example of this from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, the ruling of Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who wrote the Ashkenazi commentary to the Code of Jewish Law. He deals with a case in which you're going to sell idolatry-related items to people who are not supposed to be worshiping what we consider to be idolatry. So he says, some say the prohibition against selling idolatry-related items to non-Jews applies only where they lack similar items, and they could not purchase them elsewhere. If they could purchase elsewhere, one may sell them anything. And some, on the other hand, are strict. The practice is to be lenient, following the first view, and a person of spirit will be strict for himself. So in other words, let's say, and I'm not going to get into the ins and outs of this one, so please don't ask, but let's say that we view Hinduism to be Avodah Zarah, to be idolatry. Okay? People can debate Hinduism later. Don't count me into the conversation. But let's pretend that Hinduism would be viewed as idolatry. Would I be allowed to sell incense? Would I be allowed to sell statues to somebody who is a Hindu? So Rabbi Moshe Isserles rules here that if there are other sources, I haven't cornered the market in this specialty. If there are other places where they could get it, then indeed it would be permissible. And this is what we invoked earlier regarding the issue of assisting as well. Now, there are nuances in this rule. What if all the other vendors of the Hindu idols are also Jewish? You can totally see this. You can definitely see this. What if all the vendors in this are Jews? So now, it may be true that they can get the statue somewhere else, but it'll be from someone else who would be violating this rule. So there's an argument. The Magid Mishnah in source number 23 makes the argument that there it may not be true. He's applying it to a lending money on interest case, but the same principle applies there. However, as noted by Waldenberg in number 24, many authorities disagree with the ruling that's in 23 and say that even if all the other vendors are Jewish, you would still be allowed to do so. So in other words, applying this back to our question, can you advise them of their legal options? The answer seems to be yes. The answer seems to be you would be entitled to provide them with this service. Yes?
Wouldn't it actually be better? Because if you're an observant Jew, you can also, as one of the options, if this would be okay under the rules of professional conduct, provide them with the Jewish law option as well.
Right.
With a Jewish law view, which they might not get from another Jewish lawyer. It's not a service. It's not knowledgeable about the law.
Right. So that's certainly a possibility. That's certainly a possibility that if you engage with them, there might be an opportunity to include in the conversation what Jewish law would recommend. Again, as you noted, being careful in doing so, not to overstep what you're able to do. But yeah, I guess that is a theoretical possibility.
But if they're not going to listen, they're better off being
right.
Showcased.
Correct. You'd have to be careful that you don't turn them into an intentional violator in the course of giving them advice. You have to do this in a helpful way, not in a hurtful way. Okay. The third case, preparing the documents for this loan with interest. Are you allowed to actually prepare the documents? What would you say?
Yes.
I see a yes and I see a no. What's the yes?
If it's of concern, then you can also prepare a heteriska.
Exactly.
So hang on, because that's that's specific to this vignette. In other words, there's the general question, and then there's a specific application to the loan with interest. The general question is, and this goes back to the question from before regarding the abortion, right? Not worry what you're doing as a backup step, as a background step, but actually you are engaged in the act itself. I'm writing the documents for this loan. So this is where we come back to it. Beyond the context of the loan, where there may be outs, there may be ways to deal with it, the broader question, am I allowed to actually help them within the act itself?
I think you should have a religious lawyer because he knows how to risk and he knows how to get the...
Understood, but again, that's specific to this case. We can come up with other cases.
But the actual issue is the loan itself, right?
Right.
So writing the contract, why is it any different based on the discussion we had up until now than giving advice?
Good. So Eitan points out that maybe this is different because you're still writing up documents. You're not actually engaging in the loan per se. The
loan would be between the two parties.
The loan is between the two parties, yeah.
Within the violations of interest, isn't there also a prohibition specifically on the silver to write the...
Good. This prohibition is actually considered to be broader. So let's take a look at the sources and walk through this. Take a look at source number 25, which is indeed what you just referenced. The Talmud writes, regarding a loan with interest, the following people violate prohibitions in such a case. Lender, borrower, guarantor, and witnesses, and the sages add the scribe as well. And it goes on to list the various verses that each party violates. And the last one is the one that's relevant for the scribe here. Lifnei iver, do not put a stumbling block before the blind, and so on. So there is indeed such a concern, but it's not only about an interest case. There are laws that are unique to the issue of lending with interest. But I'll give you an example, which Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach dealt with, Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook dealt with in Israel, and it's one that's always in the news, unfortunately. And that's the question of being a rabbi on a conversion where you know that the conversion candidate is not going to observe Jewish law afterwards. So both Rabbi Cook, who I brought here in number 26, and Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach were very concerned about doing that and felt that that's a violation against this rule about the stumbling block, because what you're doing now is either your conversion is not valid, in which case you're causing the world to view them as a Jew, and they're not. Or your conversion is valid, and you've set somebody up to be a Jew who has no allegiance to Torah. So you haven't helped anybody. That's what you see in source number 26 from Rabbi Cook. He gives you that logic.
The extremes without leaving anything in between.
What do you mean?
Well, a person who goes to convert, are they supposed to be the most from of the from? Or they can just be...
Right. So I'll tell you what. Recognizing the time, I'm going to hold that question for afterwards, okay. But it's a good question about how conversion works. It's true. I'm presenting a black and white case.
It's okay.
So so in terms of what we're talking about here, you have a passage in the Talmud which actually states that it's problematic to be the scribe, even though you're not the borrower and you're not the lender. You're just preparing the document. So a couple of different approaches to this. Rabbi Yona Reis, who was the head of the Beth Din of America in New York, he was the Menahel, the director for the Beth Din, and now he's the head of the Beth Din in Chicago for the CRC there, offers some element of justification, even though he's clearly unhappy, for lawyers who do this. And his justifications are specific to the interest case. He notes that very often you're dealing with a corporation as the lender. And if it's incorporated, there is a solid view within Jewish law that says corporations are not people. They, frankly, many Jews rely on this without even realizing it. Right? If you invest in stocks and you happen to own shares in a company that owns chametz, and Pesach comes, I dare say most of you do not sell those shares before Pesach. So now do you own chametz? So the classic justification is to say, no, it's a corporation that owns it. It's not an individual. Plus the fact that I couldn't walk into the warehouse and take anything and say, well, I'm a shareholder. I'm now taking my share. But that's one element of it, which people may be able to rely on. Plus the fact that if you don't do it, they can get help somewhere else. It's not as though there aren't other people who could write up such a document. And the idea that the person who's engaging in this loan is a mumar, since he wants to do this, wants to get the loan, so therefore maybe you don't have an obligation to him. Rabbi Reis is still very uncomfortable, but he does note that you have potential justifications for this particular case. And similarly, Rabbi Usher Weiss has a similar justification in a medical context that I brought you the link for in source number 27. If you listen to the lecture that he has at that link, you could see it as well there. Clearly we're getting into tougher area here. This is already much more difficult than the issue of referral or the issue of giving advice. It's much more dicey. There are justifications for it, but we are less comfortable with engaging in the act itself. Keep in mind, the Law Society is going to tell you that you don't get to back out without good cause. And it's hard to paint this as good cause. You'd be better off catching this before you take on the client in the first place and doing the referral that way. because they can't. I'm not 100% sure, but based on the language in the rules, I think it's true that the obligation to only have good cause to withdraw does not apply to someone who's not your client yet. You just have to refer them and move them along.
Yeah, I don't think you have to take anybody.
Okay. So number four, the fourth case, is the one that continues from our discussion from last month, and that is representing a Jew in a suit against another Jew in civil court. And I gave you a reference here in source number 28 to a book that I found very useful in preparing this piece of it, The Pursuit of Justice in Jewish Law by Michael Broyd. He has a lot of very good material there that's worth seeing. So
I know Mike. I used to live two doors from him. He's just brilliant and want to read.
You lived in Atlanta?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. No kidding. Okay. Okay, so as we noted in November in the class then, Judaism has three basic concerns which lead to a desire not to litigate against another Jew in a Beit Din. Number one, the concern for divine honor. It looks like I'm snubbing the laws of God in order to pursue some other system, because I prefer that one. There is a patriotic concern, so to speak, that you don't want the Torah to atrophy and the Jewish law to atrophy. Who's going to learn it if people just go to civil court? Who's going to learn all the laws that govern litigation at Beit Din? Which we observed is actually true in the sense that when you look at what happened post-emancipation in Europe, in those communities where Jews were able to go to secular court and did go to secular court and were not allowed autonomy to handle their own cases, you find that the rabbinic writings of that period tend to be much more theoretical and much less practical, whereas in the same period, but in countries where Jews had judicial autonomy and went to Beit Din, it's much more fleshed out in terms of the practicality because they had to. So this is a concern as well. And then there's the religious element of it. Justice in Judaism is a religious activity, on a par with, you know, going to mikvah or prayer. And therefore, it's supposed to be viewed in a religious context. You know, it's like a person who says, instead of going to mikvah, I'm going to go to a bathtub. That's the way that it will be looked at, to go to a civil court as opposed to going to a Beit Din. But the question you have to ask here is the following, and it goes back to the point regarding the loan as well. Is there any prohibition for the lawyer? Is the prohibition only for the litigants and not for the lawyer? If the prohibition is only for the litigants, it's the same as vignette number three, right? There's no difference. Is there any prohibition for the Jewish lawyer in litigating for Jewish clients in civil court? And the answer seems to be no. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef made this point in source number 29. A God-fearing lawyer who is asked to represent a plaintiff who claims money in court is halachically required to refrain from this, for he aids sinners. That's what Rabbi Yosef says. But what has he not said? It's what he didn't say that matters.
That's what the litigants are at.
He said the problem is aiding them to sin. He did not say there's any prohibition for the lawyer personally. In other words, the issues that apply are the same ones that apply in all the other cases that we saw. Are you aiding somebody else in doing something inappropriate? But there's no issue. I'm going to stick with this for now. Just hang on. Let me walk through this. I'm going to come back to why I'm saying that. There's a reason. The idea here is that in so much as I'm not supposed to help someone do something inappropriate, if my client wants to do something inappropriate, so I'm not supposed to help. But the prohibition against litigating in secular court is not on the lawyer, is what Rabbi Yosef is saying. It's only don't help a client to do something inappropriate. But there's nothing wrong with a Jewish lawyer going to litigating in a civil court. Not everybody agrees with this. Rabbi Menashe Klein, in source number 30, disagrees. He does not like it. He thinks that the prohibition applies to the Jewish lawyer as well. But it seems from the literature that I've read that the majority view is with Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, not with Rabbi Klein, and that the the prohibition against litigating in secular court is really for the litigants, not for the lawyer. There's even discussion about whether the lawyer who is involved in this is called a shaliach l'dvar avera, is called a proxy for sin. Are you an agent of the person who you are representing? But the general assumption, as I outlined in 31 and 32, is that one would not be considered to be their agent at all. And I'll explain it outside of the text, because I think it'll be clearer if I say it outside the text. There's a general principle in Judaism which says that there's no such thing as a proxy to sin. Meaning, if I go up to somebody and say, I'm going to give you money, you go steal, I'm paying you, to steal from a third party. Okay, I walk up to somebody and I say, you be my agent, you steal from somebody. This guy then gets caught. Is he entitled to say, well, I was just the agent of Torchiner. I was the shaliach. Don't blame me. Can he say it's my fault? Right? In secular law, there is this aiding and abetting and whatever. But from fundamentally, in Jewish law, there's no such thing. It's the person who sends. I'm sorry, it's the person who does the act who is liable, not the sender. The person who engages in the act should have known better. Because God said, don't do it. And even if Torchiner says, do it, that's, you don't listen to Torchiner, you listen to God. And therefore, you're not supposed to engage in the wrongdoing. So the argument would go that the lawyer who's going to civil court cannot say, well, blame the litigant who sent me, because it's his own wrongdoing. However, right, Breud notes this based on the comment in the Ketzot HaChoshen in source number 32, that's only true in the event that the person who goes to do it would have been under the prohibition himself or herself. Meaning, in the case of theft, no one is allowed to steal. But the prohibition against litigating in civil court is only on litigants. It's not on other people. So therefore, they didn't actually do anything that was wrong. Is this clear? I realize that it's a funny concept, but it makes sense. You're only responsible for what you do as someone else's agent if the prohibition would have applied to you personally, if you were acting independently. But you're the lawyer here. You're not the person who's being judged in court. And therefore, the prohibition doesn't apply to you. That's the argument for why you're not considered to be a shaliach. You're not considered to be his agent. So the prohibition does not seem to be on the lawyer at all. The only issue is, are you assisting somebody else in sinning? Right? That seems to be the question. Are you assisting somebody else in doing something that they are not supposed to do? So we've already said that the prohibition against assisting where you are so directly involved is a concern, right? That was what we talked about in terms of writing up the documents for the loan. We really didn't want to be in that situation if we could avoid it. However, there is still the leniency of they can get this elsewhere. So take a look at source number 33, Rabbi Gedalia Felder's ruling, which he wrote up in a book, a tribute book, in honor of Rabbi Soloveitchik. He's talking about a lawyer who was asked to represent, and he says, I get this question all the time, and he says the lawyer is allowed to do it. He has done nothing, for if he would not accept to represent them, others would come, Jewish or non-Jewish, and arrange it. Even if you don't represent the client, someone else will. Therefore, there is no issue of aiding transgression, and even without license from a Beit Din, one should not prohibit a lawyer from doing this. He said it is allowed. I'm in the interest of time, I want to make sure to clarify a couple of things. So Rabbi Felder's argument is that, in fact, the lawyer would be allowed to do so. Now, here I want to make a critical point, and Moshe was edging towards this, but I wanted to hold it here. You may have other options, right, in this case of litigating in civil court. We talked about this back in November. Meaning, first of all, if there are non-Jewish litigants in the case, you may not need to go to the Beit Din in the first place, subject to our discussion that we had a month ago. Number two, if your client is the defendant and is being sued, then you are allowed to respond in civil court, and that's why I structured the case as being about the plaintiff. And even if it is the plaintiff, remember that there is the possibility of getting a license from a Beit Din to pursue the case in civil court. And as I mentioned in the class in November, I've done that for people on various occasions where people had cases and they wanted to be able to litigate in civil court for various reasons. And so I sent a quick message to Rabbi Vail with the Toronto Beis Din and said, is this the kind of case where the Beis Din would send them somewhere else? And he spoke to people on the Beis Din and said, no, this is a case that can go. One was a landlord-tenant case. Another was a case involving a firm with Jewish and non-Jewish partners. And they got licensed to be able to go elsewhere, and the lawyer can in fact assist with that. And going back to the Ribis case, to the case of lending with interest, it is also true that there is a workaround for lending with interest, and it could be the observant lawyer can actually help people to pursue the case in a way that fits Jewish law. So in terms of our last two cases here, the issue of preparing the documents, it would really be better not to get into this situation in the first place. But if one is in the situation, there are grounds to do it, because if they don't go to you, they're going to get it somewhere else. And in terms of representing them in court, it appears that the majority view is that this is not a prohibition for the lawyer. The issue is for the litigants. And Rabbi Felder permitted it for the lawyer to represent Jews in this. The only case I would know where it's flat out going to be a real problem is the last source I brought you from Rabbi Broid. Once one side in litigation, this is litigation between Jews, so once one side in litigation actually seeks to have the dispute adjudicated in Beit Din, and Beit Din accepts jurisdiction and orders both parties to appear, it is a violation of the Jewish court's order to assist the recalcitrant litigant in pursuing a prohibited secular remedy. Right? So in other words, you're the plaintiff in the case, and the defendant says, I want to go to Beit Din, right? And the court, the Beit Din is ready to accept it, so you can't now help somebody subvert that. That would be a significant problem. But other than that, one would be able to represent. There are a couple of things that I want to follow up on by email afterwards, one being the question of taking a fee for a referral to do something that was not consistent with Jewish law. Another is I want to find out what the story is. Is there a fee or is there no fee for using the open referral service? And then there was a third item here as well, which I wrote in my notes that I want to take up possibly. Oh, I want to send a link out for the class on wills. Please make sure that you signed in, especially if you want to get notification of future sessions. Because people tend not to need credit or pursue credit in January and February, I think the next class that is scheduled is in March. But there are other classes going on, including, again, for those who weren't here in the beginning, take a look at the pink flyer for the Tanakh in a Day program coming up on Sunday, December 24th. Thank you very much.